Hello and welcome to Words of Wisdom, a podcast dedicated to reflecting on the wisdom of the Book of Proverbs. Your host is Dr. Jerry Weirwohl, who will share life-giving truth from Proverbs that will help us become wise and discerning. Wisdom is a journey, and we hope you will join us for this exciting adventure.
Proverbs 9:9 says, "Give instruction to a wise person, and he will become even wiser. Teach a righteous person, and he will increase in learning." This is a simple proverb with synonymous parallelism, where both lines are essentially saying the same thing, or at least a very similar thing. Both lines of the proverb are describing the wise or righteous person as one who understands their own limits in knowledge. While being wise and being righteous can only be achieved through teaching and instruction, the proverb is pointing out at the fact that there is no ultimate endpoint in the journey. Both the wise person and the righteous person, no matter how wise or righteous they might be, have room for growth. They're not perfect individuals who have obtained some sort of enlightenment and are at the absolute pinnacle of wisdom or righteousness. Far from it. In contrast, the wise and righteous person, they're depicted as growing and maturing individuals like everyone else. The difference is that they recognize the need to continue growing and excelling even more in their knowledge and understanding. A quick note before we continue. In the proverb, the terms wise person and righteous person are referring to the same individual. In the book of Proverbs, you can't be a wise person and not live righteously. And in the same way, you can't be a righteous person and not live with wisdom. These two characteristics cannot be mutually exclusive, for they are dependent upon one another. And while not synonymous, their interdependence suggests a very close relationship where to say a person is wise is also to say they are righteous, and vice versa. To say just a little more about a righteous person, throughout the book of Proverbs, the terms righteous person in the singular or the righteous in the plural, they contain both a religious dimension and an ethical dimension. Regarding the religious dimension, it refers to those who are in covenant with Yahweh and living in obedience to Yahweh's precepts and commandments. This entails trusting in and submitting to Yahweh as the true ruler and sovereign of the world, and worshiping Yahweh as God alone. From this commitment to Yahweh then flows the ethical dimension of being righteous, which consists of seeking to help the poor, oppressed, and powerless in society, being willing to disadvantage oneself for the benefit of others in the community, and living with understanding and prudence about how the world operates so that one can promote life the way Yahweh desires for humankind to best flourish and achieve His purposes for them. Both the religious and ethical dimensions of being righteous indicate that such a person has knowledge and wisdom and lives with the fear of Yahweh, conducting themselves in a way that exhibits the virtues that Yahweh desires for all people to possess and display. For all of us, the road of wisdom is a journey, not a destination, and everyone is at a different place on that journey. But no one has ultimately reached the end of that road. This is the power of having wisdom. One can understand the road that they are on in life and the need to constantly move forward on the road of wisdom. And moving forward means having a willingness and desire to learn so as to then improve. This reality is stressed at the opening of the book of Proverbs, where Proverbs chapter 1 verse 5 says, "A wise person will listen and increase in learning, and a discerning person will get wise guidance." The core characteristic of a wise person is that they are teachable and that they know that they need more instruction. They are willing to listen and thereby increase in learning. A wise person is forever a student, a constant learner, always growing and improving and never becoming complacent with where they are at. But I think this is exactly where the trouble comes in. We as humans tend to think more of our knowledge and abilities than is really true. We think we know more than we really do, and we think we can do more than we can really do. I want to focus on the issue of those who think they know it all. You see, know-it-alls are not a rare breed. I'm sure we all know someone who thinks they have an answer for everything. Well, at least they believe they have an answer. Whether or not the answer is even relevant or helpful is another question altogether. But apparently these individuals have a desire to show everyone else how smart or knowledgeable they are. And they're keen to capitalize on every opportunity they can to let everyone know that they already have an answer. But that's not all. On top of that, every answer they do give, they believe is always right, at least to some degree. And they will painstakingly talk you through why they believe they are right, even if only partially. And if you try to correct them or offer a better answer, they don't listen. And if it seems like they are listening, what you soon find out is that they were just waiting for you to stop talking so that then they can tell you again why they're still right or explain away your point of view and replace it again with theirs. Does anyone know someone like this or experienced a conversation that went something like this? I sure have. Regarding these sorts of individuals, the famous Danish scientist, writer, and poet Piet Hein said it aptly in one of his most succinct and profound poems when he wrote, quote, "Those who always know what's best are a universal pest," end quote. Now, whether someone acts like they know it all because of pride and ego, insecurity, or a desire for attention, it doesn't change the fact that it is a foolish thing to do. Fools think they know it all, and their way is the right way. This is why Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15 says, "The road of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise person listens to counsel." The fool doesn't even realize that he is a fool. But in addition to that, the fool doesn't realize the effort it takes to become wise. And therefore, they don't see any need to listen to others so as to then become wise. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 7 says, "Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear Yahweh and turn away from evil." In a book entitled Outliers, author and journalist Malcolm Gladwell presents the concept of the 10,000-hour rule. The premise he argues for is based on empirical data from chess players in the 1960s, where it takes about 10,000 hours of dedication to chess in order to master it. People wrote about how long it took to become a chess grandmaster, and all the literature was stating or pointing at that it took at least 10,000 hours. But time is not the only factor that leads to success, Gladwell asserts. He also says that talent and deliberate focus play a significant role in mastering a particular skill. Just because someone spends a lot of time doing something doesn't necessarily guarantee that they will become good at it. Moreover, how someone practices and who teaches them plays a significant role as well. What that means is that it makes a difference how you learn, that is, the material you study, and how you study it, and who you learn from, that is, who your teacher is, who instructs you. Very few people ever achieve expert abilities and great success in a short amount of time. Sure, some can get lucky, but consistently being adept at something is a whole other matter. For example, you might be able to get a hole-in-one on a par 3 in golf, which is a better score on that hole than 99.9% of all professional golfers. But that is a far cry from being good enough to qualify and compete in the PGA Tour. When talking about success, we must keep in mind that we are referring to the ability to produce consistent and repeatable outcomes of success, not just one-offs. For example, anyone can make a lot of money in the stock market if they guess correctly on how the market is going to behave. However, the chances are that they don't really understand financial investments and the stock market, and if that is the case, then they will lose a lot of money in the long run. In order to understand the stock market and the numerous factors that play into the way the market fluctuates requires in-depth knowledge and experience. But let's not stretch the point that Gladwell is making. It's just a rule of thumb and a guiding principle that it takes significant time, proper instruction, and lots of repetition to get good at anything. In a similar manner, no one wakes up one day and just becomes wise. Sure, you could make a couple good decisions here or there, but that doesn't make you a wise person. Becoming wise is about developing the aptitude to make wise decisions repeatedly and consistently. And that takes a lot of knowledge, discipline, and practice, just like anything else. In order to illustrate this proverb, I want to share a story about Atul Gawande, one of the top surgeons in the United States of America. In an article that he wrote for the New Yorker magazine, Gawande explains that he has been a surgeon for 8 years. He remarks that for the past couple of years, he sees his performance in the operating room having reached a plateau. One might think that he has mastered the surgical skills and is at the peak performance of his career, but that's not the way that Gawande sees it. Gawande reminisces about the early years of being a surgeon where his skills seemed to constantly be improving, and he would compare his results against national data, and he was consistently beating the averages. But a couple of years ago, he says, his performance wasn't getting any better, and he was no longer beating the averages. One time when he was watching a tennis match with Rafael Nadal, he was struck by the fact that even someone as elite and skilled a player as Nadal had a coach. Gawande conceded that most athletes in the world have a coach to help them be the best they can be, but doctors don't need one, and that just seemed to make sense to him. However, as he thought about it, he wondered, why did I find it inconceivable to pay someone to come into my operating room and coach me on my surgical technique? Here is an extended excerpt of Gawande's experience hiring a surgical coach. Quote, I decided to try a coach. I called Robert Osteen, a retired general surgeon whom I trained under during my residency, to see if he might consider the idea. He's one of the surgeons I most hoped to emulate in my career. His operations were swift, without seeming hurried, and elegant without seeming showy. He was calm. I never once saw him lose his temper. He had a plan for every circumstance. He had impeccable judgment, and his patients usually had few complications. He came to my operating room one morning and stood silently, observing from a step stool set back a few feet from the table. He scribbled in a notepad and changed position once in a while, looking over the anesthesia drape or watching from behind me. I was initially self-conscious about being observed by my former teacher, but I was doing an operation, a thyroidectomy, for a patient with a cancerous nodule that I had done around 1,000 times more than I'd been to the movies. I was quickly absorbed in the flow of it, the symphony of coordinated movement between me and my surgical assistant, a senior resident, across the table from me, and the surgical technician to my side. The case went beautifully. The cancer had not spread beyond the thyroid, and in 86 minutes, we removed the fleshy, butterfly-shaped organ, carefully detaching it from the trachea and from its nerves to the vocal cords. We sat in the surgeon's lounge afterward. He saw only small things, he said, but if I were trying to keep a problem from happening even once in my next 100 operations, it is the small things I had to worry about. He noticed that I positioned and draped the patient perfectly for me, standing on his left side, but not for anyone else. The draping hemmed in the surgical assistant across the table on the patient's right side, restricting his left arm, and hampering his ability to pull the wound upward. At one point in the operation, we found ourselves struggling to see up high enough in the neck on that side. The draping also pushed the medical student off to the surgical assistant's right, where he couldn't help at all. I should have made more room to the left, which would have allowed the student to hold the retractor and feed the surgical assistant's left hand. He had a whole list of observations like this. His notepad was dense with small print. I operate with a magnifying loops and wasn't aware of how much this restricted my peripheral vision. I never noticed, for example, that at one point the patient had blood pressure problems, which the anesthesiologist was monitoring. Nor did I realize that for about half an hour the operating light drifted out of the wound. I was operating with light from reflected surfaces. Osteen pointed out that the instruments I'd chosen for holding the incision open had got tangled up, wasting time. That 20-minute discussion gave me more to consider and work on than I had had in the past 5 years. It had been strange and more than a little awkward having to explain to the surgical team why Osteen was spending the morning with us. He's here to coach me, I said. Yet the stranger thing, it occurred to me, was that no senior colleague had come to observe me in the 8 years since I'd established my surgical practice. Like most work, medical practice is largely unseen by anyone who might raise one's sights. I'd had no outside ears and eyes. Osteen continued to coach me in the months since that experiment. I take his observations, work on them for a few weeks, and then get together with him again. The mechanics of the interaction are still evolving. Surgical performance begins well before the operating room, with the choice made in the clinic of whether to operate in the first place. Osteen and I have spent time examining the way I plan before surgery. I've also begun taking time to do something I'd rarely done before, watch other colleagues operate in order to gather ideas about what I could do. Since I have taken on a coach, my complication rate has gone down. It's too soon to know for sure whether that's not random, but it seems real. I know that I'm learning again. I can't say that every surgeon needs a coach to do his or her best work, but I've discovered that I do. I'm ostensibly an expert. I'd finished long ago with the days of being tested and observed. I'm supposed to be past needing such things. Why should I expose myself to scrutiny and fault-finding? I've spoken to other surgeons about the idea. Oh, I can think of a few people who could use some coaching, has been a common reaction. Not many say, man, could I use a coach? Once, I wouldn't have either. I think one of the most important things that Gawande's story reveals is that no matter how good we are at something, there will always be blind spots in our knowledge and or abilities that we can't see. And it takes someone else identifying those for us in order to become aware of them. And then that allows us to focus on working to address them so that we can become better. This is the moral of the story for both an elite surgeon and a wise person. Just as Gawande concluded in his experience with having a surgical coach, the wise person knows they have blind spots and are not ashamed to admit it. But they have the wisdom to recognize that if they can receive more instruction, then they can become even wiser still. And it's not just realizing this fact that makes a person wise, but it is also the wise person's desire to work on growing in wisdom that makes them truly wise. And that is why the wise will get wiser. Let's be like the wise person who's not afraid to say they don't have all the answers and be willing to receive instruction and increase in learning so that we too can become wise. This is the wisdom of the proverb.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Words of Wisdom podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, we would be so appreciative if you would share this podcast with your friends. And if you have been blessed by this work, please consider supporting the podcast by clicking on the donation link in the description.